Kiyoroshi, Glenn Webroshi. In March 2010, he received Inca, which is a Dharma transmission in the Cold Mountain lineage of Rinzai Zen. And since 1994, he's led the Zen community at Rutgers, where he also works as a professor in the English department. As I mentioned, he's now the spiritual director of Cold Mountain Zen, and the author of several books, most recently Buddha at the Apocalypse, Awakening from a Culture of Destruction, published by Wisdom Books, in which he challenges our assumptions about time, about religion, and about the nature of progress. So I'm very happy to welcome you all here tonight, and thank Kurt very much for presenting.
Zen, so if I'm covering material you already know, please forgive me for that. I'm not sure people really understand Zen very well. Do any of you know about koans? Have you heard about koans? A couple people. The title of this talk is The Sound of One Hand Clapping. You may have heard of that if you've read books on Zen. In Zen, people meditate on these strange cryptic sayings. So there's a saying, sound of one hand clapping is something people actually meditate on. It's like a mantra. So you sit down on a cushion, you straighten your back, you do yogic meditation, and then you just say, the koan is actually just the sound of one hand. It's actually not the sound of one hand clapping. It doesn't really matter, but you basically say, one hand, one hand, one hand, and then something happens. And you go to see the teacher in private, and the teacher either expresses approval or disapproval. And if the teacher expresses approval, you feel like you've answered the koan. And if the teacher expresses disapproval, you go back to your cushion, and you try again. Does that make any sense? So, you know, if you were to go to a Zen temple, you would see all these people sitting on cushions like this, silently focused on something. Then you'd see them get up at the end of the day and go in to see the teacher, one by one, in private. You'd see them go in, the door would close, and you'd see them come out. And it's possible, if you look very carefully, they might have a little smile, or they might have a little frown, you know, and then they sit back down. And you could say, what's that all about, you know? If you read books on Zen, you read these crazy koans, these crazy stories, and it's possible to read a lot about Zen and not to understand it at all. So I was hoping to try to... And by the way, the style of teaching in Zen is not to explain anything. So a good Zen teacher won't help you at all to understand things. In fact, a Zen teacher might actually try to confuse you. So go figure. But, so I thought tonight I would try to not confuse you. And try to explain things a little bit better. You know, this is the West. You know, New Jersey counts as part of the West, I guess. And the West is all about reason. Right? I mean, that's what we're all about. And yet, you know, for the, about the last 100 years, reason has proven to be like very problematic, right? I mean, I'm sure you have studied, you know, Nazi Germany in the 20th century, and it was really an astonishing event because Germany was the most well-educated society in the world at the time, and it was the home of all these enlightened philosophers. So Kant, okay, who was like Mr. Enlightenment, Mr. Reason, came from Germany, and other just a long line of distinguished philosophers. And probably no society had embraced reason so fully. And yet, you know, Germany went like totally crazy, went completely crazy, and did these terrible, terrible things. And after it was over, people went on. You know, it's like, okay, we made a big mistake. But I don't think we have really come to terms with that event. And now we're in a very strange place as a society because we still believe in reason, but we do all of these incredible, incredibly irrational things. How many of you happen to see An Inconvenient Truth? Probably a lot of people. It's a wonderful movie, right? I thought it was superbly done. Al Gore lays out an incredibly rational, well-supported case for global warming. It's very reasonable, learned, and exhaustive, and inspiring in a lot of ways. But it hasn't changed anything, in my opinion. It hasn't changed much. And I don't know if you've been following these events, global warming and things like that, but we just had the Durban Conference. Perhaps you are familiar with the Durban Conference. But all of these scientists are just screaming themselves hoarse, saying, we have a terrible problem. We're headed for destruction. If this happens, hundreds of billions of people's lives will be put at risk. And the scientists understand this, but the general public is, you know, hears it, and probably in Europe, this is widely accepted. People really actually hear, it's a different story, you know. A lot of people don't believe it's true. They have, okay. But even where people are reasonable and rational and well-educated, unlike here, in other words, people don't do anything. So all these people came to Durban, and they all, I was reading an article about this, and they said they kicked the can down the road. So now we'll solve it in 2020. Mm. Okay, 2020. But of course, 2020 might be too late. So you can say, this is, what's wrong? You know, what's wrong? I think we see ourselves as rational beings, and we have created a rational society, but it's not a healthy society. It's not a function, even at times not even a functional society. I think we haven't figured out how to get out of this dilemma, but I think perhaps something like Zen might be very helpful. The title of the talk is The Sound of One Hand Clapping, Zen and the Unconscious. And in the West, we have a concept of the unconscious. It's very recent, as you know. Around the time that Europe was going totally crazy, even though it believed in reason, Freud came around, Freud arose. And Freud was really, I think, this incredibly heroic and intelligent person, because Freud was he was the first person in the West to say, take seriously this idea that not everything that went on in the human mind was a matter of reason. He said, you know, we have this other life, which is reason is here, and then under reason there's this life of unconscious. And so I think Freud was this incredibly courageous person, and actually, he's very original. There really wasn't a lot of thinking in Western culture about the unconscious until Freud. And so Freud is trying, I think, to respond to, in some ways, the general craziness of society, because Freud was living in this society where everybody was educated to be reasonable. And then Freud was meeting patients who were functionally debilitated, even though they were capable of performing rationally. Something under the surface was really roiling and destructive. He would see patients who would stab themselves and things like that. You know, they could carry on an intelligent discourse, but they were very self-destructive and so on. So Freud appears in the West just as the West is going crazy. And then the West went crazy, and then we're where we are now. And Western psychiatry and psychotherapy have continued to develop in very interesting ways. So after Freud, especially in the United States, you get a kind of therapy which is familiar to most people. In fact, Freudianism has become very powerful in the West. Everybody knows about repression. If somebody wants to insult you, they'll say you're very repressed. You're very repressed. People know about the unconscious. And in America especially, psychotherapy has developed in a really interesting way around the idea of the self. There's a kind of ego psychology that's become very powerful in the West. If you go to a bookstore, there's many books that are based upon ego psychology. I think ego psychology is wonderful, and I think American psychotherapy is wonderful. I think it's really a great achievement. I'm very interested in a psychodynamic psychotherapy, which I think is one of the greatest achievements of Western culture, where people come in and work with a therapist, and they begin to go through their unexamined baggage, and they begin to work through their traumas. And I have known many people who have been hugely helped by Western ego psychology and by psychodynamic psychotherapy. When you were in college, you probably studied Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Did you study that? Yeah. I think that's a really great achievement. I mean, it's really wonderful where he talks about, the developmental sequence and how people will eventually reach a point where they can be self-actualizing. I was 5 years old when the 60s started, and that was like the golden age of self-actualization, and it was really beautiful. I mean, I was wonderful. I think that was... So this is how things have gone in the West. I think there was something seriously wrong with our society. I think people were... I think many Western people were actually mentally ill, and I think we developed a Freudian psychiatry and then ego psychology and Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And I think we have produced a society that's much, much healthier. I think therapy is one of the great achievements of Western culture. And I think if the Germans had had therapy, maybe they wouldn't have had Hitler. I really believe that. So I have a great respect for that. But I'd like to say that it might not... the self-actualizing human being might not be the solution to all of our problems, that might be too limited a view of the human mind and of mental health. And so even though there's been this wonderful achievement in the 20th century, even though Freudian psychotherapy, Freudian psychiatry, and psychotherapy has been this hugely effective medicine, I think we have a bigger problem than that. Did any of you see this book when it came out, which was something like Bush on the Couch? Did Indiana, you see that? You saw it? Wasn't that a great book? A psychiatrist did what's really not professionally good practice. But he actually psychoanalyzed. He had never met Bush, but he psychoanalyzed Bush based upon all these film clips. And he talked about Bush's Oedipal relationship with his father. And I just thought, this is every word of this has got to be true. You know? Obviously, I'm a Democrat. But, you know, I recently read this same psychiatrist is coming out with a book on Obama. Oh, no, but it's hugely interesting. He talks about the fact that Obama basically was abandoned by his fathers, and that basically Obama's his great fear is a split in the family. So he's constantly trying to conciliate with the Republicans. He wants to keep the family together. And they talked about his relationships with women, which are very complex. His mother forced him to study and be excellent, but he wasn't emotionally nourished. I read this and I just thought, this is so telling. This explains so much. So I really love psychotherapy, and I think it's wonderful, and I think these insights are really valuable. But then if you say, okay, you know, Bush was a very unhealthy person, and Obama has some real, is a kind of a damaged person in some ways. What kind of person do we really want? What would be a healthy person? And the answer we would give is like Maslow's self-actualizing person. And I don't think the self-actualizing person will really solve the problems we're facing now. Because I think our problems are really quite bigger than that. They have to do not with just with our relationship with ourselves, you know, our mothers and fathers, and our fulfillment as human beings, which are really important things, but our relationship to the world, and you know, our relationship to the world. So my feeling is, I've been involved with Zen for 35 years, so you can see where this talk is going to go. I'm going to say Zen has something to offer. I think that's true. Zen is part of a tradition of Buddhist practice, which is very, very interested in the unconscious. Like Freudianism, around the 5th century, of the Common Era, there were a group of people who were unhappy with the Buddhist psychology. They said, you know, people are meditating, but they're not really waking up. They're not really awake. And they started a new movement called the Mahayana, the Great Way. And their particular school was called the Yogacara. These people had a very distinctive view. And they said, you know, really, the unconscious is much more important than we realize. And that actually the unconscious has to play a much more a fuller role in our lives, or we can't be healthy people. I think Freud had met some of these Yogacara people, they would have had a lot to talk about. But the Buddhist paradigm, or the Zen paradigm, is rather different from psychoanalysis, I think. And I'm not a psychoanalyst, and maybe there is one in the audience, and But I don't think they're the same, and I think Zen has something kind of unique to offer. So I want to, having said all this, I want to shift now to Zen psychology, Zen, the Zen view of the unconscious. Some of you may have had this experience where you go on a vacation to a place that's very celebrated, and it doesn't turn out to be much of a fun time. So you could go to maybe Kauai, and you get tourist brochures to go to Kauai. Kauai is in Hawaii. And you could look at the pictures, and you could get the guidebooks, and you could be totally excited about this. And then you get to Kauai, the plane lands in Honolulu, you have to take a ferry over to Kauai, you get to Kauai, you get to your hotel, it matches the picture in the book, you're there, and for some reason, it doesn't click. You know, it doesn't click. Okay. So, on the other hand, you know, you come back from Hawaii, and you just decide one Saturday to go to Cheesequake Park, you know. And you go to Cheesequake Park, and you walk around, and all of a sudden, something is different. Yeah, something is different. It's like your there's a psychological shift, and you feel different. You know, I'll never forget the first time I became consciously aware of that experience. I grew up, I spent part of my life in Washington, D.C. My dad worked for the government. And I used to work construction in the summer. I had a summer job. My friend Larry Sullivan and I used to drive out of Washington, D.C. up into the Shenandoah Mountains. We would get there late on a Friday night, and we would pitch a tent, and we stayed in the Shenandoah Park, there in the National Park. We got there one night, and we had been there many times, but we pitched our tent and we went for a walk, and it was the moon was in the sky, and the leaves were shimmering in the wind, and we were walking along this road, and you could see the road was sort of dappled with light and dark. And Larry said to me, "Do you feel that?" And I said, "Yeah, it's amazing. Right? It's amazing." It was like a waking dream, right? It was like a waking dream. Every once in a while, people have these experiences, right? And I didn't understand what that was all about, but it was so palpable, and Larry felt it too. It was, you know, I have been outside in the moonlight many times, but it wasn't like that. And I have been walking on summer nights and so on, but something happened there. And you know, you could go to Kauai, it's the tourist mecca, you can have a nice hotel room, and that doesn't happen. But there's sometimes there's this experience of a kind of resonance between yourself and the world. And the source of that resonance is I would say, unconscious. You know, this is a famous Zen symbol. If you go to a temple in Japan, you'll see this symbol probably somewhere in the temple, maybe all over the temple. And if you ask a monk, you say, "What does this symbol mean?" The monk will say, "I don't know," okay. Because they don't know. Okay. But it does mean something. What do you think it means? Just let it go. What could it mean?
Something about the unconscious.
Oh, you're right. You're a quick study, I have to say. I'm shocked that you got that so quickly. Okay, what else can we say about this? Okay. Anybody? What could it be?
Connections among differences.
Yes, very good, yes. Connections among difference, yes. And anything else? Just pre-associate, please.
The entire world.
Why do you say that?
Because everything's made up of those shapes.
Okay, yes, all the possible forms, right? Anything else? Well, those are all good readings of this. Another way to think of this, sometimes this is thought to be the earth. Sometimes this is thought to be heaven. Okay. But heaven, for Buddhists, isn't in the sky. See, that's the thing. You could say that heaven is the unconscious. So it's a different view of the unconscious than like the Freudian unconscious. But one way to think about this is this is the world of form. And this is the world of, we could say, spiritual concerns or something. Or the unconscious. What's this? In the middle.
Man.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
What was it?
It's man.
Oh.
Yeah. Human. 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 Right. And notice it's like Zazen. He's sitting on a cushion. Okay. So, actually, this is like a little map of what Zen is trying to do. And it sits in the temple, and nobody understands it. But it's really a good representation of what Zen practice is all about. Because basically, normally, what is especially in the modern world, what has happened is that people are, there's like a very rigid wall up between the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. And we worked very hard, actually, we worked very hard over many centuries to create that wall, actually. People in other cultures, it's much that wall is much more porous in many other cultures. There's an anthropologist named Clifford Geertz. Has anybody heard of Clifford Geertz? And Geertz says, you know, basically, Balinese people fall into a trance like that. You know, they get together, they listen to some music, somebody dances around, and everybody's in a trance. That doesn't happen in the West, right? I mean, we have a particular culture that is very much into rationality, conscious, a very narrow kind of consciousness. And actually, from the Zen standpoint, this is actually quite unhealthy to have such an unbalanced mind. It's like, it's just the human and the rational, we could say. And this is totally neglected. And so this is like unhealthy, and it's quite typical of the way we live in the modern world. I don't know if you've ever heard of there's an architect I really like, whose name is Juhani Palasma. Has anybody ever heard of him? He's wonderful. He writes about, Palasma says, rationality has destroyed modern architecture. And he says because all of the buildings we design are designed for, he actually says, visuals set only and a ration reason, you know. That, so there, and he said we don't really appreciate the whole human being in when we design buildings. And his a perfect example of that would be something like a classroom in a university, because a classroom is a box, right? And he says there's like this paralyzing illumination, right? So everything is highly illuminated, right? So you can see everything. This is like reason, right? You know, you can see everything. And he says people in this condition have to be very attentive and present in a very shallow and unhealthy way. And he says, Palasma's from Finland, and he talks about architecture. He said we should design architecture that brings alive all the senses. And one of the things he talks about is how important shadows are. So he says, you know, a nice building should have a play of light and shadow. And he said, when you're not in that blinding direct light, when you're sort of in the shadows or you're looking at shadows, he said it begins to release all of this unconscious energy. And he said, you know, actually, when you're in a healthy environment, you start daydreaming. You know, the boundary between yourself and the world, between inside and outside, begins to break down. And you begin to experience that resonance that is the essence of like a healthy life. So what we've done in the modern world is to separate the unconscious and the conscious. And in some ways, we're afraid of the unconscious. You know, actually, it's terrifying for us. We think of it as like dangerous and untrustworthy. And we're afraid, in a way, that if we're not rational beings, we'll become insane, right? I mean, this actually, Freud actually contributed to this. Freud had a very negative view of the unconscious, actually, you know. And he was very distrustful of things like meditation, because he said this is like a regression into an infantile state. The unconscious and consciousness can become the wall separating the unconscious and the conscious can begin to break down. And the unconscious and the conscious can operate as like partners. And this is very difficult for modern people to understand, but this is really kind of what Zen is all about. Zen starts with the assumption that we feel so separate from the world because our awareness has become one-sided. We have overemphasized the conscious, the rational, and the discriminating mind, and that we haven't cultivated this other side of ourselves. In fact, we keep the door closed on that. So a healthier person would be a person who is whose unconscious and conscious are interacting and that boundary between them would be more porous and open. So such a person is a more intuitive and more connected with the world around them. So that's the desired state. In Zen, we call this the unified mind, the unified mind. So, you know, conventional, like Western psychotherapy, is based upon the idea of actually bringing to consciousness your unconscious, sort of emptying out the unconscious, and then being able to have a healthy relationship with the world in a conscious way. If you want to think about Zen as a kind of therapy, the aim is not to produce a kind of self-actualizing person, but to produce somebody who's highly connected. So the goal of Zen practice is to produce a connected person. Normally, when we're under stress, when we're frightened, you know, our impulse is to withdraw into ourselves. And if we're modern Western people, the impulse is to withdraw into yourself and become highly critical or highly reflective, right? And Zen meditation is based upon something very different, which is that when you feel frightened or when you feel disoriented, your impulse is to connect with the world outside of you. So this is like fundamentally different kind of a psychotherapy. The goal is to produce somebody who is intuitive, somebody who has access to the unconscious processing, and who can we talk in Zen about a bigger mind. So the Western mind or the modern rational mind is like brilliant. You know, people are brilliant people. You know, they can do. They can. There was an article today about the Higgs boson in the newspaper. I don't even know what a Higgs boson is. I thought a boson was on a ship, right? You know. So, but the subatomic particles, right? Yeah. And that's really amazing. I couldn't do that in a million years. It's so interesting. Nevertheless, you know, from the Zen standpoint, all of that knowledge is imbalanced, and there's this other way to live, which is much more open and intuitive. And so, if you want to understand Zen practice, the goal is to produce this kind of open mind that's open in one direction to the unconscious, and open in the other direction to the world. And there's a kind of a spontaneous openness to this, and it's characterized by the lack of like a reflective distance, the lack of that distancing consciousness, and there's this powerful identification. I think that the Zen ideal is to experience the self as, to experience the world as self, and the self as world. So this is very different from like a self-actualized person. Because from the Zen standpoint, when the mind is, the unconscious and the conscious are working in tandem, in harmony, you can identify or be or feel connected to the world to a very powerful degree. And when this happens, the sense that we talk about the empty self, sense of self is dislocated. You experience things around you as part of yourself, and there's a kind of larger identity. And so you begin to identify with other things. You experience other things as part of the self. Now, this this could sound like science fiction, you know, this could, but this is, people who practice Zen have these experiences quite routinely. So, people in our group, we meditate for a number of hours. Sometimes we'll get up in the morning and meditate all day. And when people enter into this meditative state, the boundary between the conscious mind and the unconscious begins to open up. And people begin to experience the world around them in this no longer self-centered way. And people will say, you know, people come in to see me in the course of Zen training, and somebody will say, you know, I feel like, you know, I was looking at somebody else's face, I felt it was my face. Or I heard a bird cry, and I felt like that cry was coming right out of my own body. Now, I actually think this is, in conventional psychiatric terms, this might be thought of as dysfunctional, or, you know, but I actually think this is very functional. I mean, one of the interesting things about our society is that we have, we don't even, unless, I think, the environmental crisis is a perfect example of this, unless we can activate the bigger mind, the unconscious mind, we can't even be aware of the problems we have. You know, so our way of life is very dysfunctional, but rationally, it seems perfectly fine, right? If you do Zen training, you might not actually feel as happy about our society as you might if you didn't do Zen training. Because once you do Zen training, you begin to experience, in some ways, how unbalanced our culture is and the kinds of blindnesses that it has. So I'm not trying to discourage you from doing Zen training, but I think that when you begin to enter into these very highly integrated states, you can see more readily how unhealthy our way of life really is. I think the biggest problem facing us as a society is this, our inability to feel connected to one another and to the natural world. And there's no way to reason our way into connectedness. It can't, the Zen perspective would be it can't be achieved. We need a different kind of consciousness. And it's not really the consciousness of like self-actualizing individualism. It's this connected consciousness, deeply connected consciousness, where self is experienced as other and other is experienced as self. I brought some visual aids. And I just wanted to say a little bit about what this other consciousness is like. I don't know how successful this is going to be, so please bear with me. Did anybody get this picture? Maybe you could look on with somebody else, but you should have a. An 11th century painting from Japan that's in a Chinese mode. Does everybody see that? Can you see that? Okay. This is, people go to museums and they see this and they don't understand what it's trying to say, but what is it trying to say? What is this trying to say about, anything. What does this painting say to you? Yeah, please.
Well, it's different than you might see where there's a concept of man dominating the environment.
Yes.
Man is just a little building that's tucked under a bush.
Yes, that's a wonderful point. That's so typical of this art, right? I mean, if you look at the Mona Lisa, which is a beautiful painting. I love Leonardo. But it's the human in the foreground and the nature's in the background. Same thing with Gainsborough. If you look at Western art, that's a classic. There's a human here and the backdrop is nature. Here's a tiny little human. Yeah?
Another thing is there's the emphasis on the space between as opposed to the things themselves.
Yes, that's really great. You must have studied this stuff, yeah? Does everybody see that point? I mean, You know, this is very interesting about Asian art. Notice how much of this is really not filled with, there's some empty space, a lot of empty spaces in this painting. If you look at like a Persian carpet, everybody sees Persian carpets, right? Every square inch has got something in it, right? Have you ever seen a Chinese carpet?
Yeah.
Well, different, right? How's it different?
The designs are sort of placed, and so there's lots of space between them.
Yes. This is huge. I mean, we take it for granted now. But all over the world, if you look at design, you won't see that until you get to China. And all of a sudden, there's large empty spaces. If you look at Asian art, what it's trying to represent and what it's representing is like a different kind of consciousness, you know. And when we look at it with like rational modern eyes, and we don't have a key to it, we don't realize this is they're representing a different way of experiencing the world. And part of it is this smallness of humans and connectedness to nature, part of nature, vast space, right? And this idea of emptiness is so important, right? Because in a way, you know, like emptiness was a great discovery, actually. The Indian people discovered emptiness, right? They discovered zero. In fact, the Buddhist word, the word for emptiness is shunyata, shunya. Shunya means zero, right? So when Buddhists talk about it, we say shunyata, it doesn't really mean emptiness, it means zeroness, right? This thing. Okay. Why would zeroness be useful? Why would emptiness be useful to people? What would be good about emptiness? It's a difficult question. It's a bad question. Let me tell you.
You can't have something without nothing.
Yes. But also, emptiness is the door to the unconscious. Right? So the power and energy of the unconscious is released when the mind is empty. And the conscious mind can never see the unconscious mind. It can never, the unconscious mind, when the unconscious mind looks at the, when the conscious mind looks at the unconscious mind, all it sees is emptiness. It's like opening a door into a black room, and all it ever sees is a black room. But the energy of the unconscious can be tapped when the conscious mind goes to sleep. So emptiness is tremendously important. Emptiness, repose or withdrawal of the conscious mind liberates that unconscious energy. And remember when I was talking about that experience I had walking along on a summer night in the Shenandoah Park? You know, the conscious mind is quiet and still. It's really empty, no longer forming concepts. Yeah. And at that moment, the relationship between the unconscious mind and the world is very primal, very primordial and open. You know, normally, we're looking with our eyes, but behind our eyes, there's a thinking process going on, right? So it's like there's a film over, you know, there's something going on back here and there's something going on here. We can't really pay attention to here because back here, there's all this busyness going on. Does that make any sense? Okay. So when the mind becomes still and empty, everything in front of your eyes springs to life. It's like magic. Everything becomes hugely alive. Some of you might have had, what was that book? Stroke of Insight?
Stroke of Insight.
There was a woman who had an aneurysm explode in her head, and it put to sleep part of her brain. And she said, everything in the world suddenly was like enchanted, magical, alive. You know? And so it's not a fantasy, it's not mysticism. You know, same thing happens when you meditate. So we don't have this experience very ordinarily because we are so undeveloped. We have a like super strong conscious mind and a semi-comatose unconscious mind, right? So we're starving it to death. So you know, when you see people sitting on a cushion and doing all this meditation, if you ask them what's going on, say, I don't know, nothing. You know, what are you thinking? Nothing. Or I'm thinking too much, you know, I can't stop thinking. But eventually you stop thinking. And then there's no information, apparently. But when you get up off the cushion, it's like everything is highly alive. And you have this tremendous sense of being alive. You know. So this is actually illustrating a different way of seeing the world. I don't think the person who did this was trying to do anything special. They're just representing the way they see the world. There's some other differences with Western art, too. You know, where's the center of the painting? Yeah. It's you know, like, since the Renaissance, all Western paintings have a vanishing point. They all have a vanishing point, and usually the important thing is right at the vanishing point or a position right near it. There's no vanishing point here, right? You can just go on and on. See, every moment, when you're in deep samadhi, we call that state where the unconscious mind and the conscious mind are partners. When the door is opened up, we call that samadhi, samadhi. In samadhi, every moment is fresh. See, you know, they've done studies of people, they wire up their brains, and Zen people respond to the moment very differently than, but ordinarily there's something called a dampening reflex. So if I do this, and then I keep doing it, after a while your brain just tunes it out, right? But actually, if you're Zen meditators, it doesn't tune it out. Every time you hear it, it registers as like a fresh impulse. So this is like representing the world in samadhi mind, right? It's like every moment, you can just go, there could be more panels. We could just keep adding panels forever, right? There's no center. Every moment is the center. See? This is like a little lesson in Zen. Okay. One more. Did anybody see this pine tree? What is the artist trying to say? Anybody want to take a stab at this one? What's the artist trying to say? This is a very beautiful Japanese painting from about the 14th century. Yes?
I sort of feel that it's about when you see these pine trees, right? So there's the more visible ones.
Yes.
And then there's sort of the less visible and sort of like every space is sort of embodied with a pine tree in a way.
Yes.
Sort of every space is sort of inherently sort of this pine tree.
Sort of saturates everything.
Saturated, yeah.
Yes, I think that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to comment on the picture? Yes.
Maybe what you can see in the foreground with your eyes is not actually accurate as to what is really there. It's like you know that it's an entire forest full of pine trees, but you can only see the ones in the front. So it looks like, so if you were to see it two-dimensionally, you'd only see the two or three, and you think, okay, it's two or three, but it's actually a lot more than that.
Why didn't they draw the whole forest, I wonder? Yes?
Well, there's a softness that's even dreamlike because that forest could be there and you just can't see it.
Okay.
It looks to me like when you threw something through mist.
Yes, sort of misty. Yeah, it could be a forest in mist. All of these are good possibilities. When you look at it, how do you feel?
Quiet.
Still? Anything else?
Some kind of stage, like stages.
Yes.
Of something.
That's very interesting. In the first panel, it's like
it's
something is emerging.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and then it's visible, and then the end of the painting, where on the right hand side, it's going down or.
I think that's great, you know. Something comes out, something is emerging,
mm-hmm.
and then it becomes finally clear, and then it disappears, and then something else arises, you know. This is like, this is a kind of, I would say maybe this is a representation of the samadhi mind again, right? that this is like unconscious, the play of the unconscious and the conscious. You know, the mist is sort of like the unconscious, right? I mean, we don't experience the world really as a continuum. We experience, you know, the mind suddenly becomes aware of something, and the whole universe becomes pine tree for just a minute, yeah. And then the mind moves away, you know. Does that make any sense? So anyway, I think these are representing different kind of consciousness. This is sort of representing a mind that's about in moving from unconscious into conscious, conscious into unconscious. Does anybody know this? Has anybody seen this before? This is like a famous Zen artist named Sengai. Sengai. I just showed this to a bunch of Japanese high school teachers. And I said, can anybody read this? And they said, no, nobody can read it. Even Japanese people can't read it. But I think this is another, I mean, we could spend a lot of time with this. And how do you feel when you look at this? Well, this is like writing, right? This is your intellectual mind, discriminating mind, ideas. This is like in here, right? It's like the unconscious mind, the empty unconscious mind. You know. So this is like a harmony, balance of the conscious and the unconscious mind. Yeah. This Sengai was a monk, Zen monk, and basically this is like a symbol of lots of things, right? Unity, circle is unity, wholeness, emptiness. And emptiness and wholeness are inextricably connected. You know. So this is like a healthy mind. This is like a little picture of a healthy mind. You live in the world of ideas, but you also have access to this other deeper mind. And anyway, one more thing and then I'll stop. This is going on too long. Thank you so much for being so patient. Did you get this little handout with it, which had these poems by Basho? Look at the third one. The temple bell stops and the sound keeps coming out of the flowers. Anybody want to comment on that? What's going on with that?
I somewhat close to what you're saying. The temple bell, that sound, is physical impression that erupts. When there is silence from that, you still have something that come out from the unconscious, which are the flower.
Yes, that's good. Yeah, that's like a different mind works in a different way in samadhi, right? It's like that boundary between self and world is gone, a boundary between conscious and unconscious. So this is like this picture. It's trying to show how a healthy mind works, right? And the other one is very famous too. Old frog, old pond, a frog leaps in, water sound. Another way this is translated is old frog, a pond leaps in, splash. Right? It's like, where did that splash happen? In here or out there? In a healthy mind, it's impossible to say. Yeah. Okay, so let me stop here. I hope that was okay. So do you have any questions or thought responses? Yeah.
Do people sitting help the world?
I think that's such a good question. I mean, I do think so. You know, obviously, I've spent 35 years doing it.
But the world's in a lot of trouble.
No, I agree.
No.
But I think so many, you know, if you think about it, I mean, my personal feeling is that all of our problems, we have really solved many of our, like, technological problems. Most of our problems have to do with our inability to control our minds. I mean, we could be very happy right now. You know, we have central heating, we have pretty good medicine, you know, and things are getting worse. And you think about it, we have plenty of money. The world has plenty of money. Only a few people, about 1%, have it all, right? But those are all factors that have to do with our minds. There's something fundamentally wrong with the way we create our mental world. You know, it's very unhealthy and very isolating. And I think that produces greed and all these other problems. So even though it's sort of utopian to think that everybody might do meditation, that's very utopian, nevertheless, I think that even if a small number of people do it regularly and cultivate this balanced consciousness, I think it can make a huge difference. It doesn't really take too many Gandhis, you know, to make India better, you know. So I do think that a little, one drop, you know, is very effective in a big ocean. Yes.
If this philosophy comes out of the East, I guess with your Japan and other countries of the East, where did they go? How do they lose this? Because this comes out of that culture, and that culture has as many problems as we do.
I agree. I mean, it's inescapable, right? I mean, that's definitely the truth. I think it's complicated, though, because I don't think this culture... I do think in some parts of the world, like in Bhutan and Tibet, this culture still survives a little bit, you know. But I think most modern Chinese are just like Americans, you know. Even in places like Thailand, where most Buddhists don't meditate, you know, they just go to the temple and light incense, you know, and so, but I do think this, I think the people who did meditate in Asia created a distinctive culture that was built around this idea of, I mean, these paintings and everything are really like didactic, they're really sending a message about, one of my Zen teachers trained in a temple in China, and above the temple it said, the motto was calm the waves. Calm the waves. There aren't any waves. This is in the mountains. You know, it was about controlling your mind. You know, working. So I think, you know, historically, the Chinese were forced to open up to the West. I mean, basically, the British sold drugs. They sold opium. When the Chinese tried to throw the British out and say stop selling opium, we invaded. And I think the Asian people were humiliated again and again. This happened in India too. You know, so. They pretty much have realized if we don't get on board with the Western world, we're going to be trampled on. I mean, this happened in Japan too. You know, when American Admiral Perry came into Yokohama Harbor with his guns, he said, "You either open up or we're going to take over." So I think all humans have a tendency to be, you know, we can all be selfish, we can all, but I think many of the confusions in Asia that we see today have to do with their attempts to modernize and meet a Western.
So, are you saying that they didn't have problems of violence and their natures were totally different and were not as they are today until the West intervened in the East?
No, I didn't say that.
Oh, okay.
What I said was that they had a different culture than they do now that put emphasis on different things. And I think that's inarguable. And I think in some parts of Asia, we see glimpses of that older culture. You know, Tibetans are just as violent as anybody else. You have Tibetan criminals and so on. Nevertheless, I think that Asian cultures had a deep understanding of the human mind. And I think we only started to develop that in the 20th century with people like Freud. So I do think we have a lot to learn from what they were, maybe not what they are now. Yes?
Well, we were in Japan, and in a lot of ways it's a much more peaceful society and trusting society than you would in the United States or China, for that matter. I had an Olympus camera that broke when I was in Japan. I brought it into a shop to fix it. He tried to put in batteries. He opened up a package of batteries. It didn't work, so he didn't charge me for the batteries. But he sent me to an Olympus store. They took my camera, right? Didn't give me a receipt. They said, come back in a week. Came back in a week. And the woman came up to me, you know, and got my, you know, and gave me the camera back, right? So it was, that's not something that you would think of in the United States, and not in China either, which is not a particularly trusting society. So I think that aside from there's a lot of violence and a lot of prejudice in Japan, and a lot of racism towards non-Japanese or towards other Japanese that are, they have a lot of problems. I'm not diminishing that. But they, like the picture on that we have on the second page of the handout, of a Zen garden or Japanese style garden influenced by Zen practice. There's also a much stronger element of peacefulness in the society and courtesy, you know, in the society. When we first got there, we were looking for a temple where we were going to stay, and we met a man who took us around to the streets, you know, and he had to keep asking people where this temple was, something we just couldn't possibly have done. They don't have street numbers, you know, it's a totally different system of finding places. But it was the kind of courtesy that he showed us that was probably, it might happen here, something like that. I've shown people around who were lost. But there was a peacefulness there that is, that does seem to be a little bit unique in at least the countries I've been in.
You know, all Japanese have criminals, killers, you know. So, but it's interesting. I'm really interested in education. I'm really an educator. You know. So I have a book at home, and it's on preschools and three cultures, and it's Japanese, Taiwanese, and American preschool, and they've. Do psychological profiles of the kids, and they're very different psychologically. And the Japanese kids, and it's not because it's not genes or something, it's culture, right? And the Japanese kids are very other-directed. They scored highest on concern for others, right? And you know, when they all go outside, they all make sure each other has a buttoned-up coat, you know, and this sort of stuff, you know. Do you have your mittens on? Taiwanese kids were less other-directed and more self-directed, and then at the other extreme were the American kids, and they're very self-directed, you know. And I think that ties in with the way the sort of ecology of mind that the culture encourages, right? It's self-actualization, right? Not connection. And self-actualization is important. It's better than repression and so on. But I think there's something missing in the education our culture is giving us. I think you had your hand up.
Yeah, I have two questions. First, there was a question about what is the effect of people that meditate, no? And that question reflects our weight to rationality. You want to see a cause and an effect following, no? But in a different way of reasoning, where everything is connected, no? The fact that somebody meditate might change the world because it changes everything around at the even subconscious level. That is something that is mystic in the West also, that if I have a good thought, I change the world for the better. If I have a bad thought, I change the world for the worse.